I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. My guest today is Rob Kievsky. Kievsky is somebody that I have been following for more than a decade. I remember him appearing at the Vanguard News Network. He's published a few things at Countercurrents over the years, and it's about high time to have him on the show. So welcome, Rob.
Thank you very much for having me, Greg.
So we were going to talk about your ideas on basically recolonizing America for white people. We colonized it once, we've given it away, or it was given away from us, and we need to recolonize it again. And one way that I have put this in the past is that whites today, especially racially aware whites, need to start thinking of ourselves not as Americans, because America has disenfranchised us to a great extent, but as overseas Europeans. And we have to think in terms of how immigrants come to our society, the overseas Chinese or the overseas Pakistanis or whoever. They come to our society, they look for economic niches that they can occupy. And this is something that you've talked about a bit. So why don't I let you share your ideas on this? I think they're really valuable.
Thank you very much, Greg. It's really the project of 17 years of trying to think what is the most effective thing we can do, because, you know, 17 years ago, everyone was, this movement was there, but it wasn't really going anywhere because everyone was treating it like a feature film, something like you could just fix overnight, because I think our minds get kind of warped by TV and feature films, and we think everything can be done quickly. And if it can't be fixed quickly, then it's not even worth trying. And what we have to do, we have to really do this. This is a long-term thing. It's a lifetime project. It's not going to be solved with the gunfights and car chases and fistfights and setbacks and a montage like a feature film. This is a long slog, and you should expect to just be working in solitary, and you're working for the cause, you know, while you're working in solitary to become a small businessman. And colonize your little bit of area, and it won't be televised. Nobody's going to give you credit for it. Nobody's going to care. You know, you'd be lucky to get on. Unfortunately, I got on this podcast. I'm very grateful to Greg, but otherwise, you know, I've been working in solitary for years. And so it's not terribly glamorous, to become a shopkeeper, but it is the most effective thing you can do because, I mean, a golden opportunity is falling into our lap, and it's also a tragedy that foreigners, particularly from Pakistan and India, are buying up all the convenience stores and all the motels and even liquor stores, you know, and just taking them over. And they fire all the American clerks and they put in their own, because there's so much immigration. They've got plenty of their own people to basically enslave. And it happened in my town, a corporate-owned place that hired American locals sold out to Pakistanis, and all the Americans got fired, and they took over, and, you know, it just absolutely tore my heart out. If I could have bought the place, I would have kept the Americans and done a much better job. The place now that it's owned by the foreigners, you know, they're not doing so well. Americans don't go there. They all go to Cumberland Farms because at least still Americans are working there. So, you know, the first person, well, I mean, I think there's some of people doing this out there, but if you do an American patriotic convenience store and you hire Americans and you quietly spread the word locally that this is an American store, you know, you'll get the business, and the foreign-owned places will be boycotted, and you know, you'll people will vote with their dollar to patronize an American store.
Clean bathrooms, good coffee, things like that.
Exactly.
It's implicitly very white. One thing I want to ask, though, is why is it important to be a small businessman as opposed to an employee, or as we call them today, wage cucks? What's the difference? Why is that important?
Well, first of all, you can get fired from, you know, and it's a lot harder to blast us out of our own business. And when they do the doxing, which we've been talking about lately, it's been a, you know, if they dox you and fail and you survive, they look very weak. So we have to get ourselves kind of strongholds, or like a medieval keep, like a castle, so that the SPLC or in that one people's project can't come and, you know, blast our life apart. You know,
right.
if they come and they try to dox us and hurt us and we come through it just fine, they're weak because they tried to do this dishonorable, terrible thing and it didn't hurt us.
Right. So with the TRS doxing, Seventh Son, he survived it better than the other people because he had his own business. Mike Enoch worked for a company and they fired him.
Right, right. Exactly. And this is what I've been saying for years. I've been saying this for years, making this point for years, you know. And, you know, there's a song on the internet, look it up, "The Revolution Will Not Be Televised." That is so true. The most important things that are happening in the pro-white movement are absolutely unpublicized. It's a lot like when the CIA awards one of its case officers a medal. That medal ceremony is done in secret. The world does not know about it. And, you know, it will remain a secret for at least 50 years. And, you know, the best stuff happening with us is absolutely unpublicized. So just because you don't see it on TV, don't think there's nothing happening out there. Like sometimes when people get doxxed, and this definitely happens, they did get doxxed or they, you know, have some kind of trouble, they get hired in a business owned by, you know, one of our people. There's a decent, I mean, I can't say it's huge and it's not multi-million-dollar, but there is a network out there of us. And then, you know, and we're helping each other out. We are cohesive, you know, and we're trying to build something. Ideally, it would be a guild of merchants, you know, people like when you buy a convenience store, you learn all of the ways. You learn all the things, you make your beginner mistakes, you learn all the things to do to start up and run a convenience store. And then you have your library of knowledge of how to run a convenience store. You give it to the next guy who starts his convenience store and doesn't make any beginner mistakes because you made them all and you can tell him everything what to do. And I wanted the Guild of Merchants should be like a human resource of knowledge and also a library of trade secrets. Of how to do these businesses. And the foreigners, they don't have any competition. The Pakistanis and Indians running these convenience stores, they don't have any competition. So they're very sloppy. Their stores smell bad. Their coffee is terrible. If they have a bathroom at all, you know, it's not clean. And usually they don't have a bathroom and they don't speak good English. And you know what I mean? And people just don't like it. So, I mean, they are wide open for some competition.
Right. So one of the things that foreign groups do that's very clever is they will pool capital to help get their people set up in businesses. And then they expect them, once they're started and up and running, to chip into that capital pool. And, of course, they get a return on it. But there's a preference that they give to people in their own community. And so the community grows that way. Are you familiar with models like that? And do you think that whites could adopt those models?
Eventually. Yeah, we would have like our own credit union, like the Knights of Columbus had. The Knights of Columbus purposely would avoid Jewish banking, you know, and be their own lenders. As for right now, what you can do is you go to the Small Business Development Council, your local office. It's a federally funded thing. They'll help you write a business plan, and they'll do an analysis and tell you whether or not your proposed business will work. And they'll find you lenders, and you know they really hold your hand through the process. And they'll tell you if they think it works, then you go ahead. And if they don't think it works, they'll just tell you, I don't think this is going to work. And kind of, you know, then they don't really give you any more help because they're not going to bother with it, something that doesn't work. But you start by going to, you know, finding it. If you go to bizbuysell.com, you can see businesses that are for sale. And you go to the Small Business Development Council and kind of work with them and say, you know, I want to buy this convenience store. And so, you know, I think I can, they're selling it, you know, because it's not working for them. But I mean, they say, well, you kind of be, coy about it. It's like, I think I can do it because it'll be, you know, the locals will want to go to it. I'm going to run it in such a way that the locals will want to go to it in a way they're not wanting to go to it now. So you kind of tell them like that, you know, you can kind of say that, and they'll get it, right? That these foreigners own it and people don't go there, but you talk to the locals and they would go there if you owned it. It really helps if you want to do intelligence on the local community. you know, I asked people, you know, if I owned a convenience store here with a good coffee and clean bathroom, you know, and hiring locals, would you go to it? And if they say, yeah, you know, we would love that, then that's your kind of your due diligence that you would want to do ahead of time. And, if people want to contact me, I would be willing to talk to them more about this and fill them in the details of how to go about this. But, the credit union is a ways down the road. That's when, you know, that's when we have our millions.
Right. So what are some other business models or business niches besides just, say, convenience stores, which is the example that you've been using so far? What other niches do you think are ripe for exploitation for whites to try and recolonize?
I'm always looking for other hustles. And so I really pay attention to this. Nail salons, which are typically, you know, Vietnamese people. But I mean, American women would love to work in a nail salon. One thing you would want to give them oxygen masks because it's toxic chemicals. Hair salons are good. Those aren't typically owned by foreigners, but I mean, the old ladies spent plenty of money at those hair salons. Liquor stores, that's an easy one. And you see the foreigners buying those up. So you know that those work. Taxi and livery, those are like demolition derbies of low paid slaves. So they, you know, like a taxi company will be, they, you get a car and you're immediately in debt for $150 and you have to pay for the gas. You know, this is what most taxi companies do. And so they tell the drivers, cause I've worked as a taxi driver, and they say you make your money on your next call. They tell you to drive, you know, basically they tell you to drive as fast as possible, and they get in tons of accidents and their premiums go way up. And I mean, this is how the foreigners run it. And, you know, and the way to do that would be just to pay people by the hour and don't tell them to drive fast, you know, and you'll still make your money.
You would think that there would be regulations precisely because of that, right? That if people are out there moving vehicles around, that they have to be paid by the hour and not paid by the trip, which is an incentive to speed and be dangerous and be a public risk and nuisance. You'd think that they would do things like that. One thing that friends of mine have been noticing, and this is especially true in Seattle, is that Uber seems to be being taken over by an ethnic mafia, largely a Muslim mafia. And they're not all Muslims from the same area, but they're definitely all Muslims. You know, they can be Somali Muslims or wherever, you know, from the Middle East or as well as Africa. But chances are, in Seattle, if you call an Uber, it's going to be Akbar or Ahmed or something like that. And they all have new Priuses because their Prius is required to work at the airport to bring people to and from the airport.
Why is it required? That's interesting.
I don't know. It's probably just one more way of encouraging people to buy Priuses, right? It's a governmentally regulated place, and so they're going to try and, you know, put in encouragements for things that they think people should do, like have electric cars. It makes sense. I understand why they do that. So, but yeah, they all have new Priuses, and they're all driving an Uber. The cars often smell really bad inside because these people don't, God knows what they, I don't know what I'm smelling, and I don't want to know, I guess, right? Some of these smells we don't have names for, you know?
They'll ask every young female, do you want to be in my harem?
That's horrifying, yeah. There's also a pattern I know that has been noticed. A friend of mine, older woman, a woman in her 60s, got an Uber at the airport in Seattle, and the driver saw her come up to the car and said, I'm sorry, it's canceled. And there was a person there overseeing the ride-sharing area, and she went and asked this woman what was going on, and she said, oh, this is happening all the time. They seem to cancel calls. They cancel customers if they're white women, older white women, which is really odd. I don't know why they're doing that. But anyway, yeah, there's clearly some sort of ethnic mafia that's moving in, and what's happening, I'm sure, is that Uber takes 20%, and the driver...
I thought it was 30%.
Well, whatever, and the driver gets the rest, but of course the driver is probably getting a small percentage of that, right? And the rest of it's going to whoever's providing them the cars, basically. So,
yep.
So that kind of stuff is happening everywhere, and it's got to be happening with the encouragement, or at least the, you know, benign neglect, the lack of any discouragement of the businesses that are being colonized, like Uber, and the, you know, the political regulatory establishments in cities where this is happening. They're obviously not doing anything about it. Clearly, this is would be considered restraint of trade or cartelization or any other number of things if you tried it and you were a white guy, right? But all of this is just waved on through. It's a way, with the cooperation of the establishment, that these invading groups gain economic niches and footholds in our society.
Yep. Well, that's true. And I mean, if they can do it, we should do it. If we do it, I mean, make them come after us. However, Uber is a failed model, ultimately, because Uber drivers don't know the difference between daily gross profits and long-term net profits. So what happens with an Uber driver is that they make some money for that day and then the next day and the next day. But then when their car needs an expensive repair, they do not have the money for it. And then they go out of business unless they can get their mom to, you know, shell out $1,500 to, you know, fix their suspension, you know, or, you know, the other kinds of expensive repairs they get, the tires right. and stuff can get pretty expensive.
It's a great model for Uber because basically they get you to capitalize their industry.
Right. And I tell you, a lot of moms out there are subsidizing the share price of the shareholders of Uber, you know, because it's like you could just see these millennial kids, mom. You know, I need money to fix my car. Well, I don't have a job, right? And it's like, well, no, you know, the cost of fixing your car should be a self-extinguishing expense that comes from you know, the revenues generated. And the revenue that an Uber driver generates will not be sufficient for that car. You know, they should be putting away like at least 25 cents a mile for every mile, and there's no way they're doing that. But I mean, you know, Uber is kind of like a predator that's come along because the taxi industry was already quite paused, really, really terrible.
Oh yeah.
Like I told you before. So it's kind of like the taxi industry was weakened and was not popular with people. So, you know, when Uber came along, the public didn't defend the taxi industry because they hate the taxi industry, you know, because of the way that itself is like a Muslim cartel.
Oh yeah.
And a demolition derby of slaves.
Yeah, my standard joke is that every time I would get into a taxi, I always asked the immigrant what country he was from. And yep. Because it was almost always an immigrant. And then I'd ask him when he was planning to go back, which was often very interesting. I only had one negative reaction to that question, actually. Some guy from Durkistan got angry with me. Yeah, I mean, Uber is a horrible thing in a way because what it is, it's a highly profitable short-term business that basically destroys by parasitizing on industries that have been capitalized like the taxi industry or basically people's private cars, which are capital investments. And it basically just consumes capital. It destroys businesses, namely the competing taxi industry, which is not nice guys, but still, it's destroying an industry that's been built up and capitalized and has a lot of infrastructure. And it is destroying capital in the form of private cars. You know, it's sort of volatilizing all this into short-term gains that for people who are basically in the sort of business model niche of a guy who works at a restaurant, who's nigger rich every day because he's got a bunch of tips that he goes out and spends, right? And so
right.
It's really a bad economic parasite model when you get right down to it. And you wonder what's going to happen to Uber once the taxi industry is destroyed and a lot of people have ruined their cars and they can't replace them. What's going to happen to it?
So Uber is it's terrible. Travis Kalanick and, you know, the board, the bosses at Uber, they definitely know that it's economically not a workable model for the drivers in most cases. In a very few cases, with a lot, high population density, you know, it may work for some people, but in most cases, there's no net profit. And yeah, their car is going to go, going to need repairs, and they're not going to have the money for repairs. You know, it's, they're just scamming. So obviously the Federal Trade Commission should put them out of business. But you know, in the long run, what it's doing, it is having a positive effect on taxi companies. Because I've studied this, and when I saw this Uber thing, I was like, you know, I'm very much into economics, and the Ford Motor Company published a study saying, you know, millennials are ditching cars. They're not getting driver's licenses. So they, cause they have a smartphone, you know, so nowadays they have a smartphone instead of a car. So they say, you know, I don't need a car. I just need access to transportation. So Uber is getting all these kids hooked on, commercial passenger transportation and not getting a car. Well, you know, because Uber is a failing business model, ultimately, you know, eventually they're going to run out of suckers. That people are going to figure out, you know, once their car breaks, they can't pay for it. Then all these kids are going to be stuck. They're going to have to go back to stodgy old taxis. And so, you know, the taxi companies that survive the Uber age are going to come out stronger because they're going to have much larger market share because all these kids aren't getting cars.
Yeah, that's interesting.
And the existing taxi companies that do the, you know, really crappy job, you know, and They're very black-pilled. They're very pessimistic about the future of taxi. Their own drivers are betraying them and doing Uber calls with their taxi cars, you know, and, yeah, they're gonna go. But, I mean, I think the ones that are kind of decent, you know, and get some contract work here and there, you know, they'll survive. I mean, taxi companies, they, you know, they can get contract work. So it's not total, like to drive people to methadone clinics and stuff. So, and Uber can't do that. And also there's an aging population. So here's a tip for you. If you want to go into, and this is something I found out recently. I'm trying to gather intelligence on what hustles we can do. The aging boomer population is going to need more and more wheelchair transportation. And you can do that under a taxi or a livery license. And there's a market share for both private pay and for Medicaid. For that. So just keep in mind and, you know, I don't know how profitable it is, but I do know that's going to be a growing need and Uber will not be able to fill it.
One of the things that I've noticed talking to friends in various industries is the same pattern as you see in Uber, which is basically a kind of decapitalization by a quick money economy. So a friend of mine was telling me, for instance, that the various utilities are so concerned with quarterly earnings and things like that and kind of bump things up a little bit every quarter, right? It's just keeping everything in the liquid capital market that they have hollowed out a lot of the infrastructure of the electrical grid all over the country. And there's not a lot of redundancy. There are not a lot of spare parts. And some of these spare parts are incredibly expensive, highly specialized pieces of equipment that cannot be whipped up overnight. Some of them have production times and delivery times of 6 or 8 months, right?
Wow.
And they have maybe two of these, one in operation and one spare. And that is just incredibly, incredibly irresponsible, right? A serious country would not have its electrical grid dependent on, or so basically dependent on luck. I mean, that's their plan, right? To luck out. Dumb luck. That's the plan so that we don't have a failure of the backup and the main one. And suddenly the West Coast is plunged into darkness and it'll be 6 or 9 months before they can get the parts to replace it. There are ridiculous situations like that brewing. And it's just all part and parcel of the declining time horizons in the system and the sort of superficialization of all capital into liquid capital, right? Everything is being volatilized into liquid capital. All the hard capital in the country is being consumed. So you get a car for your graduation or something, and you could have a job, and you could use it for commuting, and that would be a good use of the money, right? But if you decide to become an Uber driver and you just get lots of cash and spend it like a waiter does, spending his tips, well, at the end of that process, you're not going to have the ability to replace the capital that you've consumed.
Correct.
Yeah, so it's just part of the hollowing out of our economy, and this is a pattern I see everywhere. And so one of the things that I hope will happen with the Trump administration is people are going to start noticing this and saying, this is potentially disastrous. This is not the way to run a serious serious country. And we're going to start paying attention to building up real capital, building up infrastructure. What's his face? Bannon is talking about spending $1 trillion on infrastructure.
Yeah, well, you know, I believe it when I see it. I mean, if the electricity goes down for 6 months, that's the end of multiculturalism, that's for sure.
That's true, but it might be the end of a lot of good stuff as well. So,
well, I mean, I'm ready to lose that good stuff for the end of multiculturalism.
Maybe so. So there are a couple other topics that we were going to talk about, and I guess that's sort of a natural segue into one of them. What's the upside of civilizational collapse? Well, the end of multiculturalism. What's the upside of global cooling? Well, that would be the end of multiculturalism in a lot of areas, too. We were talking about, before we started, about some of the ways that we can look at the Dark Age, the Kali Yuga, the Age of Idiocracy, as an opportunity rather than as a crisis. Because no matter what
right.
kind of society you live in, there are always going to be rich people and poor people. No matter what kind of economic crisis you're going through, there are always going to be people who are positioned to profit from that. And so let's just talk about that mentality, adopting that mentality, making sure that we come out on top. Yeah.
I want to mention the exponential function and how it sneaks up on us, because there's a lot of people in the movement who don't believe in the collapse anymore. Like the TRS guys. I hope you guys are listening. The exponential function is, imagine you're in a baseball stadium that's watertight and you're handcuffed to the top highest bleachers, the nosebleed seats, and there's a magic water dropper. And it just, every minute, it one drop and then it doubles, right? So the first drop is just like, you know, just a little drop of water, and the second, and, you know, and then a teaspoon of water, a tablespoon, a half a cup, and so on. So, and if it doubles every minute, how long do you have to, before you drown? And you're way up, like 100 feet up in those bleacher seats. How long do you think you have before the stadium is totally flooded?
Not as long as most people would think.
Right. The answer is 49 minutes. But at 40 minutes, the water is ankle deep. So you're looking, you're like, hey, we're fine. You know, we got a long time still. 9 minutes later, the stadium is completely flooded. So the exponential function comes up. It starts off really slow, and then boom, it just goes into hyperdrive, you know, just really fast. And we have a lot of processes in our civilization that are growing at an exponential function that very quickly will be so too big to be sustainable, and then it's all over. So, you know, if you think the collapse isn't coming, you got another thing coming. It's the exponential function.
Well, yeah, it's the guy who's falling from the top of a 118-story building, and 10 stories down, things are fine. 20 stories down, it's still fine. 30 stories down, he says, I can get used to this, right? Induction leads you to believe that the future is going to be like the past. But of course, at a certain point, it's not going to be like the past when you hit the pavement. There are a lot of processes in nature that do grow geometrically, or they double. Things like viruses, diseases when they have an outbreak, or parasites, like an algae bloom in a pond, any kind of ecologically destructive parasitic phenomenon, like an epidemic or an algae bloom, things like that, these things will grow by doubling and doubling again, or even faster than that. And yeah, something very small can, in a very rapid order, become a very huge problem. And yes, you know, when the algae bloom gets to the maximum point, all the oxygen is consumed, and then everything dies.
Yep. Yep. And, you know, liberals are very arrogant and very confident that you know, 2050 whites will be a minority, and they'll it'll be so peachy they'll have a permanent single party country, one party country, and you know, and white, you know, whites will be crushed and so on. And I'm like, in 2050 things are going to look so different than they do now. You guys don't even, you can't even begin to imagine what's going to be like. It is not going to be anything like now. So yeah, I'm serenely optimistic that multiculturalism has an expiration date well before 2050 or 2040 or whatever, because of these exponential functions. And, you know, and the best we can do is try to be heroes. You know, in the Kali Yuga, in the Idiocracy, nobody's even trying. Not even a lot of white, most white nationalists are not really doing what they could be doing. You know, they're shit posting and memeing, and that's great. But what they really need to be doing is going out there and trying to, you know, own a business, and they should be studying math and you know, and studying, and like studying. I mean, the two problems we have, we need to be merchants and we need to study like the Chinese kids do. Although the Chinese, they don't like to study. They do it because they're compelled to. The advantage a white person has in studying is we can learn to love what we're studying. And when you love what you're doing, then you do it much better. So, you know, that's the academic edge. The two things, you know, I want for the white cause is that we be merchants and that we do STEM, you know, science, technology, engineering, mathematics. Those two things, and we're gonna come out much better than we would otherwise.
Well, how do we get whites, bright whites, into STEM fields then? Where do you begin?
Homeschooling. The Robinson curriculum. Art Robinson, if you robinsoncurriculum.com, and on YouTube, he talks about it. He's a physics professor in Idaho, and he, his wife was building up the Robinson curriculum. He had three kids and a farm, and then tragically his wife died and he had to do his professor work. So he has these three kids and he's like, well, you guys are kind of on your own, but they all had their own very big desk. And he had his desk, and they're all be sitting in the room, you know, doing their work. But he gave them minimal help, only when they really got stuck. And he had them do math 2 hours a day. First thing in the morning, you know, you were going to do 2 hours of math, for Saxon math. And so, you know, 6 days a week, they didn't study on the Sabbath day. So we're talking 12 hours a week of math, 600 hours a year. By the time they're 16, they've done, 6,600 hours of math. So they completed the whole calculus curriculum by the time they were 16, and his daughter by the time she was 14. One of his sons is a PhD physicist. The other one is a PhD chemist or chemical engineer. And his daughter is a large animal veterinarian. And so the trick was homeschooling and, you know, 2 hours of math first thing in the morning. You know, and eventually when you're studying on your own, you're not, you know, in a homeschool setting, it becomes much more interesting. It's much more fun because, you know, it's like a math is the original, addictive video game. You know, how many, you know, Newtons and Leibnizes have we lost to video games? I mean, someone like Isaac Newton was a video game addict of math, right? The video game addiction is the unhealthy version of the math addiction. So you can get someone so hooked on math. It's like people who will play video games until they starve to death and drop dead. Well, you know, there's someone like Newton would forget to eat. You know, he would just be working on his problems. So that can, you know, you can put that in someone. You can raise a child to be like that.
They would certainly be in an advantageous situation when it comes to going off to college, that's for sure.
Yeah, and I mean, only 2 hours a day. The rest of the day, you do other stuff, right? But it's, you got to do the math first thing, 2 hours a day. I went, I found out that because I'm a veteran, I could go to University of Connecticut for free in my 40s. And so I was like, wow, I'm going to do that, you know, and I just worked it around my job. And I took calculus and I took enhanced general chemistry, which was the freshman chemistry for chem majors. And, you know, and I paid for tutors and I worked really hard. And when I went back to my job, which was an office job that, you know, required some organization and thinking and numbers, I was much better at my job. And I, all of a sudden, I was putting everything in order and doing everything. You know, getting the processes going that in a much better way than before, just because of studying, you know, calculus for a year. It was like math is like lifting weights for your brain. And people don't believe me when I say this. You know, in the 1940s, high school football coaches would tell the players, you know, for conditioning, you should go walk 1 mile a day. Right. And people who think they can be an intellectual without studying math. It's like that high school football player who walks a mile a day for conditioning. You know, studying math is like the weightlifting and the calisthenics and the sprinting. You know, math is like really hardcore weight training for your brain.
So you have a daughter. Is she homeschooled?
I do. No, because we couldn't afford. Both of us had to work. And she went to public school. And she wanted to be a doctor, you know, she wanted to go to medical school or do something in allied health. But she took AP calculus and I was helping her with it, you know, and preparing her. And so I was kind of homeschooling her. But this doggone math teacher, he was giving them second year calculus instead of first year calculus. Instead of preparing them for the first year AP calculus test, he was giving them integrals without even teaching them derivatives or reviewing algebra. And her homework was ridiculous. I said, don't even do it, you know, and ultimately I let her drop out because this teacher was such an asshole. And she went and took, you know, some other math class and it totally put her off on academics. And she took AP English. That teacher put her off and she went and took some other, you know, English class and ended up scoring a 4 on the AP English. She took the AP test anyways and got a 4. And the 8 kids who were actually in the AP class, none of them even got like, they all got like 2s, you know, and none of them even got them a 3, which is like, would get you a college credit. So the public school experience my daughter had was just absolutely so awful. It put her off on learning. You know, in retrospect, my God, I wish we should have just been poor. We should have lived in a double wide and homeschooled her. Because the just public schools were so awful and the kids were so awful. Her peers were disrespectful to their parents. So she was like, hey, why do I have to be disrespectful to my parents? You know, none of my friends, all my friends say F you to their parents and hit them, you know, and I am, that's what's normal. Right. And, you know, her peers, you know, watch as much TV as they want, play video games, stay up all night, you know, playing video games and, just really terrible. And, you know, there's a book by, called, The Collapse of Parenting. I forget the name, the guy's name, but he's a doctor. And he says, you know, that for children to be healthy these days, in the old days, even though the kids had friends, all the kids were parent oriented, you know, and they cared what their parents thought and wanted to obey their parents. Now the kids are all peer oriented. So, you know, they're like, screw you, mom and dad. You know, my friends are who matter to me. So, you know, you got to kind of keep your kids in a homeschooled and sheltered because, you know, the other kids are totally infected with, you know, this peer orientation. And, growing up peer oriented is extremely unhealthy. Kids need to be, parent oriented, you know, adult oriented. And that's how they grow up to be mature. These peer oriented kids, they kind of are prematurely adult, but then when the real world comes along and they got to pay bills and take care of themselves, they can't do it. They find that they're still dependent on their parents and they're quite resentful of their parents. You know, they're like, you didn't prepare me to be an adult, you know? And well, anyway, it's a tough situation. It's really awful, but really so you got to shelter your kids. You got to homeschool them and keep them away from the other kids. Cause the other kids, it's like they all got rabies, you know, and they'll give your kid rabies.
There are studies I've read in Malcolm Gladwell's book, The Tipping Point, that show just how peer-oriented children are today. And that is definitely a problem, because generally speaking, it should be parents that have the most influence on their kids' outlook. And one of the things that's most diabolical about our society today is really driving wedges between the generations and then trying to form each generation into a peer group. And of course, the peer group isn't autonomous. It's not, it doesn't create its own values. These are kids. They don't create values. They don't have critical thinking skills. So who creates their values? Well, people selling them stuff, people selling them pop culture and pause, right? And that is,
right.
That is the problem. So it's part of the marketing strategy of the system, and part of it, and it's not just marketing, it's a social engineering strategy, basically, to break down intergenerational ties between white people, break down the transfer of knowledge and values from generation to generation, and create sort of isolated peer groups that are maximally open to propaganda.
Yes. Yeah, it's a pincer movement between the mass media and the public schools. The public schools teach the kids that learning is boring. You know, they really do. And it just and then the mass media is like, "Well, this is what's actually interesting. This is what's fun." So, it's really between the two, the public schools are totally complicit. There's nothing healthy about the public schools at all. They need to get put in the oven.
Exactly. So, yeah. So Rob, we're about at an hour, and I think this is a good amount of time for a discussion. So let's segue into some final thoughts. If you had to stand up, say, at a Toastmasters meeting or a town hall or just some kind of gathering where you've got the attention of the people around you and you've got just a few minutes to give them the message that you think is most important, what is that? What's your sort of 4-minute message for our people?
Okay. Start a business, not a hobby business, a good business. Get it vetted with the SBDC and analyzed so that it's actually going to work and be profitable. Start a family. And then the great thing about owning your own business is the family gets to stay together. You know, corporate workers, they all get broken up. One's off to their job, the other one's off to daycare, the other one's off to school. The people who have a business, they can all hang out together. You know, you can have a convenience store. You can have a living room in the back of the convenience store where the family is homeschooling the kids. So, you know, you live next door to the convenience store. Nobody's commuting. Everybody's staying together. And then now you own a business. You have your independent income. You homeschool the kids and hire tutors. Try to live in or near a major city or a wealthy area. Like I have this idea of the Elysium Project, where we in Westport, Connecticut, there's 2 4-family houses going for $500,000 each. If I had $1 million, I would buy those 2 houses up and put homeschooling families in there, and we change our names to Hispanic names, and we would work with the school system to say, hey, you know, we'll take your standardized tests and make you look really good, and you know, your school system will show that you're helping Hispanic children get high test scores. And in exchange, you know, you give us money for tutors and karate class and music teachers and stuff. In the major cities and in the big towns, you have the best music teachers and the best gymnastics schools and the best dance schools and the best martial arts schools. You know, out in the boondocks, like where I am, you know, you can't find a good piano lesson or a good violin lesson or a good martial arts school. You got to go to the city. You got to go to Providence or Boston or something. So you try to own a business near a major city or a wealthy town, really rich town. And then the kids can get the best like music lessons. When I went to Russia, you'd have orchestras of like 10-year-olds that sounded like professionals. These, you know, a 14-year-old in Russia could try out for the Boston, you know, the Boston City Orchestra and would you know, have a go at it, likely be able to get in. And I said, Americans don't have this. Most American kids are deprived of really quality instruction in the arts, in math, in everything. And so you want to make sure that your kid is getting the education that the most American kids are not getting. Americans, what we have a deficit of really good education and training. And so we have to put our resources into trying to get that for our children, what we've been deprived of. And when you do, you know, the results will be great, because when you identify exactly what is missing, what is in deficit, and you fix that deficit, you know, you get a tremendous success. And I've identified it. You know, it's a deficit of owning our own businesses, of families being able to hang out together and raise kids who are parent oriented, and really good education. You know, like a kid that can play the piano really well by 11, you know, you can get these Chinese or Russian piano teachers that just teach really well, and, you know, teach them to practice really well and so on. Whereas like the American piano teachers are real hacks, you know, and or like, what do you want to do? So, you know, and a kid who gets to 18 years old like that, the rest of their parents could die and they would be fine. You know, so, and that's what I say. We got to put our efforts into the next generation, you know, and even if you don't have children yourself, become wealthy and then donate to the homeschooling families, you know, that's how we do it. And, you know, and that's, that, there's my, that's it.
It sounds like you are an advocate of Ride the Tiger Moms, basically.
Yeah. That's a really well put. The Amy Chua is a huge influence on me, both of the World on Fire, which is about the market dominant minority, you know, which I'm trying to get us to be a market dominant minority, take over the convenience stores, and also the Tiger Mom thing. Although, you know, don't do it like she does it. You know, the Chinese kids hate studying. You got to raise the kid to love studying and love training. You know what I mean? You can. And then her book, The Triple Package, about these are the traits that the successful people have, you know. But I mean, it kind of like the Triple Package is kind of like Tiger Mom and World on Fire, like smooshed together. But Amy Chua is a very important thinker, in my opinion.
Well, that's great. The way I look at it is that white nationalists represent the interests of all white people. We want to create a society that's in the interest of all white people. But realistically, we know that not all white people are going to be saved. And so in a way, what we're doing is we're becoming a new white people or a sub-race. We're becoming the white people with a future. And they're the white people who have no future. And if you start thinking about what it's like to be a white person with the future, well, you've got to have a next generation and you've got to train them well. That's what we have to do. We have to think about all the things that we can do as a community to be white people with the future, because that's what white nationalism is about. It's about giving our race a future again. And it's not going to work for all of our people. We'll try our best to save them all, but we can at least save ourselves, and we can come through this bottleneck a much stronger community that is impervious to a lot of the corruptions that are destroying us right now.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, you know, but we have to build institutions. We have to have businesses, functioning, you know, affordable family formation, right? And we don't have that right now. We're all scattered. We're all, you know, wage cucks. You know, we need to own rental properties. And be able to hire each other, be able to rent to each other, be able to look after each other. And that is happening, you know, a little bit. I mean, the revolution will not be televised. You know, this stuff is going on underground. Just because you don't see it on TV doesn't mean it's not happening, you know?
Yeah, perish the thought that we see this on TV, right? We don't want that to happen. We want it to happen, but we don't want it to be targeted, doxed, protested, boycotted, and all this other kind of stuff.
Well, I wonder, you know, in the new Trump era, is are we still going to be, does doxing still matter? I don't know, you know.
It matters a bit, but it matters less to people who are economically independent. And that's the important lesson we need to learn.
Maybe Jeff Sessions will defend us.
He might.
From the SPLC.
Yeah, right? He might. But, you know, the Jeffersonian idea of the yeoman farmer is very, very important. The the backbone of Republican liberty in the small r Republican sense has always been the farmer, and more broadly, the small businessman, the person who has capital and is somewhat self-sufficient. Those are the people who are the backbone of Republican liberty. And liberty disappears as more and more people become wage cucks. And we have to get outside of wage cucking. We have to become independent again, entrepreneurs again. And that's part of giving our people a future.
Yeah. And I tell you, when you're a small business employer, you know, it's like, if you treat the employees well, it becomes like a tribe. And you know, you're kind of like a minor feudal lord, you know, and they're like, oh, you know, I don't have any money for groceries. Can I borrow some money and work it off next week? Yeah, sure. You know, I'm going to get evicted. You know, can I borrow, you know, $600 so I don't get evicted and work it off? Yeah. You know, that happens. I mean, the small businessmen are the real, welfare. The welfare doesn't work. It's very pretty stingy for the people that I'm seeing. You know, it's the small businessmen that keep them out of from being homeless. You know, and really the small businesses are America's safety net more than big government. I see this firsthand.
Yeah, small businesses and tribes, extended families, right. Groups like that.
Right. And you know, and the thing is, when you're like a minor feudal lord, you know, you screen out the bad people, you know, and the people who survive, who act right, you know, they were like, oh, you know, I better not act like that person who got fired.
Right.
Yeah. And so to be a businessman, you have to be able to collect money. You can't be shy about telling someone, okay, you know, you owe this money and you got to pay it. And you can't be shy about firing people, you know, and my background in the movement, you know, made me like, gave me the character to do it. Right. I can fire people, you know, I can demand money, you know, because I mean, after getting spat upon by Antifa, I'm not shy, you know, I'm not afraid of people, you know, and so many people are, you know, and so it's funny if you're in the movement, if you've been in for a while and you've actually like gone through some hardship and people ostracizing and being mean to you, you know, if you go into business, the skills you need, you got to be thick skinned and hard hearted. And you already have that. I mean, you, Greg Johnson, I guarantee you have the character to be a businessman. You know, you would be able to fire someone. You would be able to collect money, you know, because what you've been in, you've gone through stuff psychically that you're tough. We all are. You know, except maybe the kids never left their parents' basement.
Yeah, well, I am running a business, basically. So, yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. So, Rob, we should wrap up, but why don't you plug your websites and any projects out there?
I don't have an internet I used to have mindweaponsandragnarok.com. It's still up. It's not updated because I got doxxed a couple of years ago.
Right.
And when my wife ran for a probate judge, so it's very easy to find out who I am, you know. I mean, you can only be doxxed once.
Yes.
And I was making $250 a month in Word ads, and you know, and the idea was like, we're in the Kali Yuga, we're in the dystopia, we're in the idiocracy, and how do we have a good life, you know? What do we do? You and me both independently, we have a lot of the same ideas, you know, because I attacked the beautiful loser meme and I had a lot of commenters saying, you know, I was thinking like a beautiful loser and you snapped me out of that. Thank you so much. You know, I kind of motivated some people to take life by the short hairs and actually do what needs to be done, you know, and the beautiful loser meme really keeps people back.
That is true. And I recommend that people look at the piece that I wrote recently on that topic, basically. I'm always forgetting the title of it. I just wrote the thing. I only write these things, but the title has escaped me. Honorable Defeatists. That's what it's called.
Read that. I thought it was like I could have wrote it myself. It was like you were reading my mind. That's a great article.
Well, thank you. Well, Rob, this has been great, and I hope this is just the first conversation of many. So thank you very much for joining us on Countercurrents Radio.
Thank you for having me. I look forward to future podcasts. It was an honor, Greg.